Are people really willing to let Time Team rip up their gardens?
What's the most extreme location for archaeology?
And what ancient artifact will I unlock the secrets of?
The answers to those questions and more on the Time Team podcast.
Hello, welcome to the Time Team podcast with Martin Williams and Helen Geek. And we are recording this as the first in an experimental new kind of podcast where we concentrate on Patreon questions. And this is my favourite bit of the Time Team podcast because it makes me think and it makes me realise what the really interesting questions are.
Yeah, I think a lot of us will end up with thinking caps on by the end of this episode, and hopefully you will as well. So lots of people have been getting in touch on Patreon. Thank you if you've done that. If you're not part of our community on Patreon, it's well worth signing up to, actually, I have to say. If you want to ask a question, it's there for that, but it also gives you loads of behind the scenes, extra extended interviews, all sorts of things like that. Much, much more from Time Team. And of course, your money goes into doing archaeology. That's one of the main things that we do. It's making programs about archaeology and doing the archaeology itself as well. So your funds are definitely well used. If you go there now, patreon.com/timeteamofficial, you'll find everything you need to know to sign up. So we're going to be featuring lots of Patreon questions in this episode. And also, I'm going to introduce a little feature to this podcast, Helen, called Helen's Find, because Helen is a finds liaison officer. And I thought I would use that and get you, Helen, to talk about an object, something that either you have found or has been found by somebody that maybe has a story to tell and secrets to unlock.
That sounds absolutely fantastic. Yes, I can talk forever about the funny little objects that we record and what they tell us about people who lost them in the past.
Well, Helen's first find, whatever that might be, coming up very shortly. But let's get into it and let's talk about some questions. Thank you for these. Got a few to get through, so let's do it. Chris got in touch and says this: were the people really so willing to let their gardens be ripped apart? This is such a good question, isn't it? And I always think this whenever I watch Time Team and it's in people's back gardens or wherever it might be. We went to Norton Disney a little while ago with Time Team where we were doing test pits in people's gardens. And I had to keep asking the people who own the houses, are you sure we're allowed to dig this big hole here? So were people willing to let the gardens be ripped up? And asks Chris, how much work was put into the restorations of the garden? Did you put the top turf back on? That sort of thing.
That is a really good question, Chris. And I also asked this question when I first joined Time Team, because one of the very first ones I did was looking at an Anglo-Saxon burial that had been found in a garden in Raunds. And I think we filmed that in March. And I remember several others that were in the early spring before everything had got going. And it was a very fragile lawn that we were removing because the grass just hadn't got going yet. And I kept thinking, are they happy? Are they really happy? Are we going to make it look just as good? Because we start off deturfing very, very carefully. We put everything on a tarpaulin. We're incredibly neat and tidy. We separate the topsoil and the subsoil, and dum-de-dum-de-dum. But then, of course, as day two goes on and as day three goes on, and we get more and more focused on the archaeology and less on the garden, we perhaps forget to always stand on the tarpaulin, and we forget to make sure that we're keeping this separate from that, and we stand on a flower bed and we bruise a bulb that's just coming up, and so on and so forth. We always spend a lot of time saying, are you absolutely sure, etc., etc., because although they may welcome us into their garden to begin with, I'm not so sure that they really are welcoming us on the afternoon of day three. But the answer to your question of how much work's put into restoring it, that is something that I think that's why I keep asking the question over and over again, because I don't actually know that. That's done on day four. And it's usually done by Kerry, who is, He's very good at putting things back the way they were, but I'm not sure he's really a gardener. I'm not sure that he's putting every plant back in every place. I often feel that we ought to ring them up in a fortnight or so and say, and is the garden all right? And is there anything else we can do? But I'm not sure we ever do. So I always feel a big sense of guilt going into gardens, and I'm just terribly grateful that people let us do it.
Well, I'm going to counter this a little bit by saying that I think that the people who do give their gardens over to Time Team and to archaeology, they are getting something out of it. I think if somebody came to me and said, we think there might be something really interesting in your back garden, I'd say, dig away, have a look. Because I think people want to know about the history of where they're from. And if that means they learn a little bit more about the history of the house they might live in, or the village they're from, or the town that they're in, I think people would welcome that, even if there is a little bit of disruption associated with it.
Well, I'm hoping so. Those are very kind and reassuring words, Martin. And the other thing that I do sometimes think of is that a garden is not a static thing. It's always a work in progress. And okay, making a big hole in the middle of somebody's lawn isn't great, but if we change something, if we move the edge of a flower bed or something like that, we might be the cause of a change in design. You never know. Maybe yeah. They'll decide to put a pond in where we dug that great big hole.
I think in our last episode, I described Naomi's flotation tank as being Ground Force meets Time Team. And I did think when I said at the time that Ground Force and Time Team were two TV shows that were on air at the same time,
yeah.
I think, weren't they? Sort of all mid-90s TV shows. But maybe we didn't need Ground Force at all. We could have just had Time Team come in for every single one, and you would have ended up with a new garden anyway.
Yes, and maybe we ought to always have a day four, which is the gardening aspect. I think maybe you've hit on a format there that might make your fortune, Martin.
Maybe. It's going to need to be very good. That's all I'll say to that. Good question though, Chris. Really good. And I suppose it ultimately comes down to how proud you are, right? I mean, there are some people that have beautifully manicured lawns, and then some people where it looks like the Somme. And I think I'm definitely the latter. Let's move on to question number two. And get ready, by the way, Helen, because I'm going to be asking you for that find in just a moment. But here comes Patreon question number two. Carl Johnson has been in touch. And Carl asks, after watching the latest classic release. Ah, yeah, there's so many old episodes of Time Team that you can watch on our Time Team Classics YouTube channel. Some really, really good ones there. And Carl's been watching Dig by Wire. Now, that was the one where you had to sort of zip line to the site, which is very, very good. And Carl poses this question as a result of it. I was wondering, says Carl, how often archaeologists do digs on extreme or difficult sites? I'm guessing it turns into a cost versus safety versus reward type situation. Yeah, I mean, what would you say is the most extreme dig you've ever been part of, Helen?
Yes. I was thinking with the advent of the expedition crew getting to inaccessible places, I was very much reminded of an excavation that I did in the Northumberland National Park, a place which is very dear to Stuart's heart. We were staying in a scout hut and excavating in freezing conditions on the other side of a mountain, and we needed to carry everything with us, everything valuable, that is, so all the surveying equipment, the tripods, etc., etc. We did leave the wheelbarrows, but essentially we had to do a very long hike carrying everything that we needed for the day, then excavate all day, then carry it all back, and then sleep in bunk beds. I was grateful for the bunk bed, but the sheer physical effort, as well as all the digging, was it was a wonderful sight, and perhaps it was worth it. But I did wish that we could have perhaps had some kind of maybe donkey to help us carry things.
That would have been good. The Time Team donkey definitely needs to be a thing. A lot of archaeology is about sort of discovering where people lived, how people lived, burials, sorts of things like that. It's all about people and where they were. And I wonder whether that means that actually in reality that most of these sites are going to be quite accessible because the people would have had to have got there in the first place. I'm just thinking, you know, like a Roman villa. Is there like a good chance that that is actually still going to be quite close to a modern road because the roads follow the same lines?
Well, yes. If we're talking about an inland site, absolutely. And another thing to say is that archaeology that's done in advance of development, that's paid for in the kind of usual commercial way, the development is not going to take place on a cliff edge or on a tiny island or something. And so commercial archaeology, the vast bulk of archaeology in the UK, is not really going to be taking place in any extreme place. But that means that the sites that are being lost to coastal erosion and any form of erosion are not going to be the ones that are covered by ordinary archaeological funding. So those are going to be research excavations paid for by Historic England or often by universities. And those are the ones that can target these places that are almost falling off a cliff. Now, I worked for a while in the 1990s on Lundy, and that was part of that was things falling off a cliff, and that could get quite extreme at times. We had to be kind of virtually tying ourselves onto the windy rock face, trying to record the remains of 19th century quarries, the granite from which had gone to build the embankment in London. But these had to be done quickly and safely in the wind, and that's not easy. And we were, the answer to that one may have been that we were all volunteers. I think it's a bit like Go Ape, isn't it? That you do these dangerous things, but you're clipped on. There are people that help, and I did have a lovely experience on the castle in Jersey that Time Team did, where we had a safety climber who organised our wires, clipped us all on, and then we could abseil down the sides of the castle and get a really good look at the masonry, all the details of the tooling around windows and so on, all the ornament. But that all had to be done with a safety person because we were absolute novices. We had no idea what we were doing. We just clipped ourselves on, flung ourselves over the edge and enjoyed the journey down.
And hoped for the best of it all.
Yes.
So you've never had to run away from a boulder or climb through rats or snakes. I'm just thinking of scenes from Indiana Jones films. That's all.
No.
You never had to fight a Nazi in a tank.
No, not yet.
Not yet. There's still time. You can make that happen. This is the Time Team podcast. Martin Williams, Helen Geek here, and Helen is answering your archaeological questions that you've submitted on Patreon, and got some more of those to come in just a moment. Stand by Roger, stand by Tracy, coming to your questions in just a tick. I think it's time that you showed your find now, Helen. So this is something that I'm trying to introduce. Helen is a finds liaison officer when she's not working for Time Team, and I thought we could do this thing called Helen's Find, where you talk about something that has been found through the process of archaeology, and we can talk about the significance of it. So what are you bringing to the metaphorical table?
Well, this is something that my thoughts turn to this time of year, when you can almost have supper without turning the light on. The days are getting longer, the nights are getting shorter, we're nearly at the equinox. So my thoughts turn to how people lit their houses before electricity and gas, that kind of thing. Before about 1800, candles were a really massively important thing. And I'm very fond of a little thing called a medieval folding candlestick. We have recorded quite a few of these on the Portable Antiquities Scheme. So if you go to that, to our database and type in folding candlestick, you'll find quite a few. But one of the reasons I like these so much is, well, they are brilliant little gadgets, but they're made from lots of different bits of copper alloy sheet, probably bronze sheet, which are all riveted together and they come apart. So I had seen and recorded a lot of bits of these without knowing what they were until I saw one from London that had been found complete and was finally published, explaining what it was. So it's a folding candlestick that you can put in your pocket, but it is so clever because it has a cup at one end and that's fixed to a kind of stem, and there's a hinge at the bottom which has a spike on it. And there's an ingenious series of folding tabs, of swiveling tabs, which means that you can open out your spike and you can jam it into, say, a table for an upright candlestick. You can even jam it into something like a wall beam, a kind of upright bit of the wall, like you'd see in a half-timbered medieval house. And you can lock it in an L shape so that the cup is still upright, and you pull out your swiveling tab, you hinge the thing either upright or L-shaped, and then you push your swiveling tab back into a slot that holds it like that. And the really best ones have got two sizes of socket, one on one side to hold a candle and then a tiny one on the other side to maybe hold a rushlight. And they feel a bit like Swiss Army knives, because they're fold up, put it in your pocket, take anywhere, so you can have a proper light wherever you go. So it's a bit like, I suppose it's more like a pocket torch, really. And we didn't know that these existed until about the mid-90s. We didn't know what they were when we found them, and we didn't know that there were such things as pocket travelling candlesticks until they were identified from this complete one that was found in London. So that they're quite a new thing, and they literally shed a new light on the medieval period, but they also shed a light on kind of travelling and mobile lights, which we often think is a new thing with electric torches and now with phone torches. But there's been a need, and where there's a need, you know, necessity is the mother of invention. These things were being used certainly by the 13th century.
Light is one of the modern wonders of the world that I think we take for granted so easily, don't we? Because it is so easy just to flick on a light, and it means that you can do whatever you want to do at whatever time you want to do it. And I that's how we live our lives now, and I don't think we could imagine anything in any other way. But I suppose finding an object like that gives you an idea of, you know, the lengths people would go to just to get a little bit of light, and how much their lives would have been dominated by where the sun was in the sky.
Yes, totally. So that the modern timetable of life is without any regard to where the sun is and what the sun's doing, but it would have absolutely controlled everything before artificial light, you know, around 1800.
A really, really good find to bring to the table. We're going to do that again, I think, in another one of these podcasts. Let's get back to the Patreon questions, though, and a quick reminder from me that you are listening to the Time Team podcast, and if you want to submit one of these questions, then Patreon is where you need to go, and do join us there. We've got a great community of archaeology fans and Time Team fans, and when you support us on Patreon, you get the opportunity, yes, to ask a question, but as I've been saying, you get the opportunity to support the archaeology that happens here in the UK and around the world, and you support the programs that we make as well, and all the community outreach projects that we do too. Time Team Official on Patreon. So patreon.com/timeteamofficial is where you need to go. Roger Brooks has been in touch, who says, what is the best way of going about taking part in a dig? And Roger's adding, I live in North Norfolk. This is something we get asked quite a lot. People see archaeology happening on the screen and they go, I want to do that, which is so great. We love inspiring people to get involved with archaeology, but how do you actually do it?
It's a very good question, and it's something that I asked when I was trying to get into archaeology as a teenager, and the answer is surprisingly still pretty much the same. The first thing you must do is you must join your local archaeological society, and for Norfolk, that's the Norfolk and Norwich Archaeological Society, and you have to hope that they have a field group, which most societies do, certainly Norfolk does. And the field group are the people who actually do the work on the ground. You know, they'll be the people organising excavations. So certainly Cambridge has got a field group, Suffolk's got a field group. They're pretty common around the country. Then the second thing you have to do once you've organised that will help you meet lots of people, but you also should join the Council for British Archaeology, because they also have local groups, so you'll be able to get involved there as well, and they often do field work too. And if you've joined the Council for British Archaeology, you will automatically be a subscriber to the magazine British Archaeology, and that has a calendar of excavations that are going on that you can join. And the last thing I'd say is also subscribe to Current Archaeology, because that again is a very good way of keeping your ear to the ground. Read the two magazines, go to the meetings of your local groups, and you'll find out what's going on.
And do keep an eye on Time Team as well. And I know, Roger, you know, you're already on Patreon. We do try our best. We can't be across everything, and our sort of budgets and things like that are limited, but we do try our best where we can to get volunteers involved in some of the digs that we do. So it's worth just keeping an eye across what Time Team is doing as well, because where we can, we do want to involve volunteers in some of the things that we get up to. Great question, though. I'm wondering that, I'm not sure that we will know an answer to this particularly, but if you are listening in somewhere that isn't the UK, I'm thinking if you're in the US or Australia, I don't know how sort of advanced archaeological groups are there because of the nature of what you might be doing archaeology on and how accessible that is. But I wonder whether there'll surely be a sort of historical society, won't there, that you can join, where people might have an interest in the archaeological process, and you could maybe sort of inquire there and take it from there. Would you suggest, Helen?
Yeah, I think that's not a bad idea. It's trying to network, really, isn't it? Find the people who are also interested in the same thing. And if you live in a university town, wherever you are, they might have a department of archaeology that might well run public lectures. Some places in Britain, the Workers' Educational Association still does evening classes. That kind of place as well, you can find people who are interested. Extramural departments. And it's just a matter of finding your tribe, isn't it?
Yeah, and you'll probably make some good friends as you do it as well, because everybody will be interested in the same thing. Great question. Thank you, Roger. Final question then in our Patreon questions edition here of the Time Team podcast comes from Tracy Hales, who says, why, when you embrace so many new technologies, don't you embrace visual reconstruction of faces when you find skulls? Now, I don't know, Tracy. In my mind, I think that Time Team has done that sometimes, but I wonder, is it just extremely expensive and so we try and we just don't do it all the time?
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that one. It is a good question. Of course, there was a television programme, Meet the Ancestors, which was presented by the very lovely, well, one of the very lovely Julian Richardses. There are two Julian Richardses. One's a prehistorian and television presenter, and the other one is a Viking age expert, and they're both absolutely delightfully lovely people. They don't like getting mixed up with each other. But the prehistorian Julian Richards presented Meet the Ancestors, which always ended with a facial reconstruction. And that was in the really early days of facial reconstruction, which was something developed for forensics, you know, for modern, identifying modern deaths, suspicious or otherwise, where all you had was the bones and you didn't know what the person looked like. And it is really sophisticated, and it produces astonishing results when you see the person in a modern context. You can compare a photograph of the person who's been identified and the reconstruction that the facial reconstruction person did from their skull, and they are extraordinarily alike, and they can give a kind of window into the past in a way that nothing else can. But I don't know whether it's expensive, because there are so few people doing it. It may not be so much that it's expensive, and more that they simply haven't got the time to do it. I don't know how much training it takes. It's not something I've ever asked about, because we've always had such good artists who've drawn on their imagination, you know, particularly Victor Ambrus, that it just wasn't part of our repertoire in the old days. But I think, you know, Martin, that we could drop this into conversation and see what people say, and find out whether it's just that it hasn't really occurred to anybody, or, as I suspect, that it's really difficult to get hold of the expertise, or if it is a budget thing. We'll have to ask.
We'll speak to the movers and shakers, and we'll run it up the flagpole, and we'll have a powwow. I'm trying to think of all the corporate jargon that we could throw at it.
See if anyone salutes.
That's it. I'm wondering, though, how would you measure the accuracy? Like, how would you know whether you were reconstructing a skull right? Because you can't see what the answer would be. I suppose yeah. you could do your test, couldn't you, where you could scan a skull of a person that is currently living, and then you could say, there's your skull, recreate that, and you could see if it came up with Helen Geek, if you see what I mean. So you could test it that way. Because I've always thought, you know, every now and again you see news articles, don't you, where they say, we've reconstructed the face of Richard III and this is what he would have really looked like. Or, we've reconstructed the first ever human and this is what they would have looked like, and their name's Fred. And I just think, well, how confident are you on that? Or is it a little bit of a kind of, I don't want to sound too skeptical, because I know a lot of scientific research goes into coming up with these things, but I'm saying I don't know enough about it, and I would like to know more about the process so that I could be more confident in saying that, oh yeah, that is what they would have looked like.
Well, I think, you know, it came out of the King's Cross fire in 1987, because that disaster where a lot of people were killed, one person wasn't identified, and they weren't identified for years and years and years. And the attempts to identify that person, that's where a lot of the research on facial reconstruction came from. And once it began, the police then, as I gather, said, well, we've got more people who we haven't been able to identify, that we've got these very slight physical remains of, just bones, really. Can you help? And I think that's where our evidence that it works comes from, because the facial reconstruction people, whose names I'm struggling to remember, I think the first one was Richard and the second one is Caroline, they produce these faces, of course, difficult with things like hair, moustache, beards, that kind of thing, colouring of the hair particularly. They produced these pictures and then said, well, does this help? Does this help work out who this might have been? And there are several instances of families getting in touch saying, that looks like our long-lost uncle that we haven't heard of since whenever. So it's modern reconstructions it's modern reconstructions with photographs that have proved that this is a meaningful thing to do in terms of identifying modern people. Whether or not knowing what somebody looked like facially in the past helps us in any way to understand their life, I don't know. It's not something that's caught on academically, I think, because there's a resistance to feeling that you can tell anything meaningful about it. But yeah, it certainly is an emotional connection, and I think that shouldn't be dismissed.
Yeah, I totally see what you mean, though. You sort of think scientifically, kind of, what's the, you know, who cares what they looked like, because they're still doing their thing. We're interested in how they lived and, you know, where they lived, and rather than what they looked like when they were doing it. But you're right, you know, you can get an emotional connection with somebody that you wouldn't if you can see their face. I just think, you know, there's parts of your body, aren't there? We need Jackie on, really, don't we? We need Jackie to explain this to us. But there's bits of your face that will decay and go away. Obviously your skin, but, you know, your nose, for example, is cartilage, isn't it? And that's not going to survive. Mm. So how on earth would you know whether somebody had a great big long nose or a tiny little one?
I mean, that's a
pretty significant feature on your face.
Yes, I don't know. And another thing, of course, is that careful stitching and plastic surgery weren't available, so any injuries are going to heal on their own and look pretty awful. But another thing I'll throw into the mix here is that while on the time team at Westminster Abbey, I got to look at the death mask of Henry VII, and it is one of the most frightening things I've ever seen. I don't really want to look into that man's face. You can see why he managed to conquer a country. I found it deeply terrifying, what his expression. The other thing is that we have enough pilgrim badges showing Thomas Becket, which was sold at his shrine in Canterbury to make money out of the pilgrim trade. We have enough of those to see that the face is the same every time, and it's so distinctive that you can get an idea of what Thomas Becket looked like too. And again, that sends a shiver down my spine. Again, another very powerful man from many hundreds of years ago that you'll never see a photograph of, but you can get this likeness. I do find that it gives me a frisson. Whether that actually tells me more about life in the past, maybe not, but but we shouldn't just reject these things that give us this feeling of jumping over the centuries and seeing somebody face to face, that they can be useful. Whether they're worth spending an awful lot of money and time on, I don't know.
I'm going to throw into the mix bog bodies as well. Ooh, because yes. the bodies, some of them thousands and thousands of years old, that have been preserved in the peat, some of them are preserved so well that the skin remains, the hair remains, and it looks like you are discovering a body that was maybe, you know, dumped 2 weeks previously. It is that good. And it's eerie looking at the faces and the expressions that you can still see on the faces of some of these bodies that are thousands of years old. And it does do that. It does allow you to put yourselves in the shoes of that person and connect with them in a way that you just can't do with bones, because that is the way humans are conditioned. We are conditioned to respond and react to faces of other humans. And when you see them for real life, it just brings it all to life in a way that you just can't do with just with bones that you dig up. A really, really good question, Tracy. And we're going to find out more about this, I think. We need to find out more about the process of reconstructions of faces and how useful it might be. I think we'll make a few phone calls and see what we can do there. That is about all we have time for on this edition of the Time Team podcast. Hope you've enjoyed it. Slightly different to the episodes that we normally bring you. Normal service is going to be resumed next week. We are weekly now, and we hope you're enjoying it. If you want to ask a question, just like Tracy and Roger and Carl and Chris have on this episode, make sure you go to Patreon to do it. Patreon.com/timeteamofficial is where you need to head. There's loads more for you to enjoy from Time Team on there besides this. Find a post that is about the podcast. So the most recent post about the podcast, it might not be about this particular one, but about a recent podcast, comment on that. And that is your best way of making sure that I see it, because we get lots of messages and they all go pinging different places. But if you comment on posts about the podcast, I will see your message, because I always check it, and we will include it in a future edition of the podcast.
Yes, and our next episode is going to be a good one. Stuart Ainsworth is taking Martin to a hill fort where all is not as it seems. And Danny's back with this month's Time Team news. So that's a lot to look forward to.
It really is. We will join you again very, very soon for the next edition of the Time Team podcast.